We have some breaking news. We were preparing to do a show already to talk about this new 28-point peace plan that's going around everywhere, about what the Russians are going to accept, what the Ukrainians are going to accept, what the Europeans will accept. And now that we find out here, literally just minutes before we come on air, there was a statement by Volodymyr Zelensky that's about as defiant and openly calling out the president of the United States, if not by name, definitely by position. Without any further ado, let's jump right into it. Gary, if you can go ahead and just throw that up there, let's roll.
Треба поговорити чесно, спокійно, без домислів, чуток, пліток, без усього зайвого. Так як є, так як я завжди намагаюсь говорити з вами. Зараз один з найважчих моментів нашої історії. Зараз тиск на Україну один з найважчих. Зараз Україна може опинитися перед дуже складним вибором. Або втрата гідності, або ризик втрати ключового партнера. Або складні 28 пунктів, або вкрай важка зима. Найважча та подальші ризики. Життя без свободи, без гідності, без справедливості. І щоб ми вірили тому, хто напав вже двічі. Від нас чекатимуть відповідь. Хоча насправді я вже її дав 20 травня 2019 року, коли присягаючи на вірність Україні.
Gary, that's cool. Now, just skip the rest of it. Run straight to minute number four there toward the end.
І це правда, абсолютно. Але і Європа, і весь світ мають розуміти і іншу правду, що українці, перш за все, люди. І ми майже 4 роки повномасштабного вторгнення стримуємо одну з найбільших армій світу. І ми тримаємо лінію фронту у кілька тисяч кілометрів. І наш народ щоночі переживає обстріли, ракетні атаки, удари балістики, удари шахедів. І наші люди щодня втрачають когось із своїх близьких. І наші люди дуже, дуже хочуть, аби війна, ця війна закінчилась. Ми, звісно, сталеві. Але будь-який, навіть найміцніший метал може не витримати.
And that's good right there.
Не забувайте про це.
That is some incredible stuff. He basically says right there out up front that he is being pressured by the president of the United States and that he has a deadline coming up. According to some sources that I literally just spoke to, that date is 27 November. So very, very soon from now, barely a week, as a matter of fact, less than a week. We'll see how that's going to work out. Now, as it turns out, we also have a tremendous guest with us today to try to make some sense out of what we're hearing both here and elsewhere, and that is Alistair Crook, geopolitical commentator, foreign diplomat, and conflicts forum at Substack.com. Alistair, wow, what a good fortune to have you on today. Let me just jump right in. What is your reaction to this open declaration that he's being pressured by the U.S. to end this war?
Well, the pressure to end this war, I think both on Washington and Zelensky, is not about Thanksgiving and having it all done by Thanksgiving. It is about the collapse that is taking place on the battlefront. On the battlefront, because that network, that line of defensive cities are all falling. And behind the defensive cities is just open fields. They'll just cross them right up to the River Dnieper. And that the same thing is happening in other parts of the front line. In Zaporizhia and Kherson, there are key cities and positions that are suddenly falling. It's almost a sort of cascade. I think occasionally, and I've seen this long ago when I was dealing with Afghanistan, on the border with Afghanistan, you know, suddenly something snaps and the morale, everything goes. It's like that old story about bankruptcy. How does that bankruptcy go? Well, it goes slow, 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 and then very fast. And that seems to be what's happening on the front. So when he talks about all the pressure he's under two pressures besides, if you like, this propositions that have been formulated into 28. The other one is that his party is turning against him and turning against his chief of staff, Yermak, particularly. He has a party support, but many of his party, the party which has a dominant position in parliament, is splitting and joining with the opposition and demanding a unity government, a national government. They're demanding that the head of his office is sacked. There are many of them have now taken refuge in Israel. Quite a few of them, the energy minister, the other ministers are all over the place. They are really so there's a political collapse. There is a military collapse. And perhaps this is the point at which the team of Trump thinks this is the moment that they can push and get some sort of pressure on Zelensky. However, Putin's response, well, you see that in the picture there. What is his response to these 28 propositions, paragraphs of propositions? There he is in military uniform, which he does very rarely indeed. He's in military uniform on the front line. And what does he say? The people of Russia require and need the special operation to be completed. And that is our end. Our purpose is to complete the special military occupation's objectives entirely. So I think that is his response. I have to say, probably at the end of it, Russia will not just say, we won't discuss anything, we're going to sort of pull a wall down. That is not Putin's style, it's not Russia's style. But it won't fly, these 25 propositions in Russia at all. I mean, the elements of it. I mean, this is clearly an effort, and I've written about this. This is clearly a bait and switch element, by which I mean is that they have come up. And I just like to say something about the standing of these papers, because it's really important to understand it. Kirill Dmitriev, who has been talking to Witkoff, is not an envoy. He does not represent Putin. He does not represent the foreign ministry of Russia at all. He has no official standing in the negotiations at all. I don't even know. Zakharova was asked I think yesterday, and she absolutely, we've not been informed. We know nothing about it. The Americans have told us nothing. We know nothing about this. And that is the same from the president's spokesperson, Peskov. Dmitry Peskov said exactly the same. You know, this is nothing. We have no part in this. There are no formal consultations with the United States or proposals under consideration at all. So I don't even know whether Dmitriev actually cleared his lines. That's Peskov on the right talking with the president. Now, I don't even know whether Dmitriev has actually cleared this got a thumbs up from anyone to pursue this dialogue with Whitaker. What is it standing? It's just a speculative paper that has been put out. The Russians won't accept most of it. It doesn't provide for all the things that they require. They require the recognition of the four oblasts that have been incorporated in the Russian constitution. It doesn't provide, for a peace process. It is going back to the old General Kellogg position. Ultimately, this is all about, when you read through it carefully, as I've done, and I came to, it's quite clear this is to try and make a ceasefire. Now, in Moscow, this is seen as extremely dangerous. They've been there before. They were there during the Minsk talks, where they were put under huge pressure to agree to some sort of ceasefire. And of course, it didn't work. It failed. And they are absolutely adamant they will not do a ceasefire. The way they have to move to a proper political, if you like, discussion, which contains and goes to what Putin referred to, and he referred to it again, his principles of the root causes of this war. And the root causes of this war is not about territory. It's never been, you know, a little bit of territory here, a give up of a little territory there. It has always been about the neutrality and the lack of a threat coming from Ukraine and an end to NATO's push. He wants a new security architecture for Europe that will provide Russia with security. I just to put it into context, at the moment, the United States has missiles in Romania and Poland. The Polish missiles, the flight time is about 9 minutes. Flight time from Romania to Moscow is 7 minutes. These can be nuclear with nuclear warheads. Originally, Putin asked, this was Biden at Geneva, and he said, are you planning to put your missiles then in Ukraine? And Biden said, no, we wouldn't do that. But afterwards, Blinken saw Lavrov, and he said, yes, we will put missiles in Ukraine. And we will not discuss that. We may discuss with you just a limitation on the numbers. That's all. And the time for that would be 3 minutes flight time. Not enough time to determine whether a missile has a nuclear warhead or not. And I would just say, I mean, they take this very seriously. You know, I've just come back from Moscow. Now, I think there's a great worry, particularly about the language coming from Europe. This language of war, war, war. You saw the German defense minister just 2 days ago, Pistorius, was saying, we're preparing for a war. Russia will attack by 2028 or even next year. And then now we've had the head of the French army talk about saying, right, European must be ready to sacrifice our children. We have to give up our children to fight Russia. So they're very concerned. Now, if you look at it carefully, you would probably come to the conclusion. You'd say, look, there's no money in Europe. I mean, you know, when they talk about a large budget for building the German army, it's all through issuing debt. And debt is problematic in Europe now, just as it is in America. And so none of this, there is no money in the European budget. There is no money in France. There's no money in Britain. Germany is stretched too. This is no money. The armories of Europe are empty. They don't have enough. I think in Britain there's something like they have a total of 40 tanks. And there are not the manpower. And so if you look at it, you know, carefully, you see, is this just bluster? Is this just hyperbolic talk from the Europeans? Because, you know, how would you put an army together to fight Russia in this talk? And so you say to the, you could say to the Russians, look, this is all nonsense. There just isn't, because there's also another factor. Europeans are not culturally ready for a war, that we're all too soft, all too talking about our holidays and what, you know, what the latest fashion is. They're not culturally, young people have no desire and no wish to take part in a war. And the last reason is that there was, in the ancient world, the Chinese relate the story. When the emperor was said, what are the three things you need for war? And he said, and the sage that talked to him, he said, well, he told the sage, you know, we need food, we need weapons, and we need trust. And the man was asked, Well, if you had to choose one, which would you choose? He said, trust. And that is completely absent in Europe today. No one's going to send their children off because that
really raises a troubling question as to why so many in Europe, and I mean, we're talking Merz, we're talking Starmer, Macron, I mean, quite a number, certainly in the European Union as well, Kaya Kallas and Ursula von der Leyen, et cetera. I mean, it's like all solid in the choir singing about threats coming from Russia. You can add the Baltics into that, et cetera. But you're right. The capacity to actually wage war is simply not present. But the rhetoric is quite strong, and the Russians are responding to what they're hearing. I mean, what else can they do? But the question is then, why would the Europeans say something that they literally can't back up?
They're saying that they can't put 1.5 million men in the field to fight Russia. It's just not feasible. But what they can do, and what I think is the intent behind this, is they would like to have another Pearl Harbor, an event that brings America reluctantly into a war with Russia at this time, and not with Germany. But it's Churchill, Roosevelt, and the attempt to pull it in. So what they're looking at is not a big war, but a war that is, if you like, in the Baltic. You know, there's a very narrow channel there down the Baltic Sea. And there's an Estonian rock in the middle of it to make life difficult. So you fly an aircraft near it or a ship near it. And then they say, oh, you know, drones and cut cables. And you could see that it could, they're looking for a Pearl Harbor to pull America into a big war because there's no capability to do it. And then the question that the Russians have to ask themselves, what is the right level of deterrence to stop this happening? Because they're in a very difficult situation. And you can understand, well, you know, do you have to go to maximum deterrence? Do you start talking nuclear weapons straight off? Or do you find a sort of escalatory ladder for your deterrence? And you know, I was talking to the Iranians earlier because the previous foreign minister, Abdalassian, who was killed in that helicopter, shall we call it accident, that took place a little while ago. And he always said, you know, the line between diplomacy and deterrence is a very fine line, and you have to balance it, get it exactly right. You do too much deterrence, and you might incite your adversaries to respond themselves by escalating their military operations. Too much diplomacy, too much openness to diplomacy, and what happens? It's seen as weakness. And your adversary might respond by escalating in that case. So you have to find this difficult line between the two elements. And this is
if I could just say, I might add a third one to that in the current environment, and that's stupidity. Because if you're not talking smart on deterrence or on diplomacy, and you're talking nonsense where you literally don't have the capacity to back up, you may invite attack just because they see that your mouth is bigger than your wallet is, and you actually can't make good on those. And that's the part that really troubles me. Let me just add one other thing there. You mentioned that Europe may be thinking they're looking for a Pearl Harbor type thing to draw the United States in. Let me tell you, you just talked about how Britain's not capable, how France is not capable. The United States is also not capable of entering from scratch into a high-intensity warfare of the nature that would be done here. We can't sustain anything here. And we would all together just be sucked down if we actually got into a conventional war. And that's praised, hopefully, to God that it would never escalate into a nuclear, which is all too possible. But even if it stayed conventional, I argue that we would probably get our butt handed to us, especially initially. What do you think?
I agree with it, but I think that what is concerning, and the Russians are right to worry about it, is two things. That first of all, As Putin called it, Trump has been seen by them to be capricious. He used the word capricious. But actually, most people are now saying that they think he's somewhat wacky. I mean, I don't know how it translates very well into Russian, but they do see him as becoming really unpredictable. And they see the United States with a number of really deep structural economic problems. They understand that there are bubbles in the economy. They understand that the debt situation is becoming drastic. And the tariff, the whole tariff structures are under discussion in the Supreme Court. So they look at all these and say, right. Well, with all these problems, does that make Washington more likely to, more open to a resolution and to a normalization of relations with Russia? Or does it do the opposite? Does it actually end up by doing, there will be a lashing out or a diversion in order to get away from economic problems, and that the targets are Iran or Russia or Venezuela, and that we will see some erratic response of that sort. And again, the question therefore is, do you have a deterrence which goes to the maximum, the nuclear one, or do you have to try and find some sort of level up the escalatory ladder that doesn't provoke or doesn't lead you into the Third World War? And this is, and the point is they have to do the due diligence to work out, what it is Europe, why Europe is saying all these demented things. And what does that mean? And I am saying that, they see that and they see that Europe seems to be preparing for war, even though, it's not possible. And they don't know about the United States because there is no contacts. There's very few. There are no channels, really, of anymore. The old, channels, the track two channels, have largely gone. They have gone, in fact. So they don't have a feel, and they're very... And you can imagine if you don't, you just rely on the newspapers and everything, they don't really have the feel to judge. They see Europe as in a state of complete structural decline. And they see America has these big problems in there. How do you plan? How do you have a sort of deterrence? And I mean, I would say to you, probably as a military person, you find that rather strange. But they say, we've lost deterrence. They would say we've lost deterrence against the West. And I would say that's right. I mean, it is. If I say to someone, oh, look, if you use Tomahawk missiles in Ukraine, there'll be a huge, drastic reply from Putin. And, there's that sort of nod of the head and say, oh, Alistair, we've heard that before. We don't believe that. He'll never use weapons, nuclear weapons or anything like that. So they know, you can see they're right that they've lost deterrence. But I believe, and I would hold that it actually is in the Western interest for Russia to have deterrence. Because if they don't have any deterrence, they are not going to feel stable themselves. I mean, the instability is transferred, if you like, from one to another side, because, they don't want to, but they don't want to feel cornered into having to resort to the sort of maximalist deterrence.
And in fact, if I could kind of go down that path, Gary, if you could put that CNN headline back up you had a second ago, this is what's being reported right now. Trump is giving Russia almost everything it wants with this Ukraine peace plan. But as you, I think, alluded to in your Substack article there, and in fact, when we look at some of the points of this 28-point peace plan, there's a lot of things on there that Russia doesn't like at all. And I'll just pick one. This issue that at point number 21, where they have to give up portions of Zaporizhia and Kherson, which from all I've been hearing from folks who had direct access into some of the senior officials in Moscow, is that that's a complete non-starter. They won't even contemplate something like that. Only the June 2024 terms that Putin put up. What do you say to that?
Oh, you know, it's just non-negotiable, because even if Putin wanted to negotiate on those terms, he can't. First of all, those four oblast provinces have been incorporated into the Russian constitution as a part of Russia. But the more important thing to realize is because, you know, there was a vote and a referendum, and the people of those provinces effectively voted to be Russian. They said they wanted to be Russian. Now, you can't override that. I mean, it will be, you know, it would be impossible for Putin to do it. Constitutionally, he'd have to go back to the Duma or the parliament and to change the constitution. No, he's not capable of doing that. That is a red line, and it will not change. These are his principles. And in that in that 28 points, which I think you may have read or glanced through, did you see anything about the main point that he makes, which is the root causes of this war, which is the question of the extension of NATO from Germany, the borders of Germany, further and further and further, and, if you like, encompassing. There needs to be some sort of agreement that establishes, if you like, boundaries. You may not agree on everything. You may not dislike Russia or dislike its government or something, but what he is wanting is some boundaries. People understand, you know, within your boundaries, that's fine. Cross your boundaries, and then everything happens. You've got to have some sort. And this is what I'm talking about really with deterrence, boundaries. And we saw this very clearly in the sense where my wife, who speaks Arabic, when you go to Sicily, where there are lots of Arab communities there and communities from the Middle East, many of whom she knows quite well. And she says, but how come there's no violence? How come you know, it's relatively safe and peaceful here? And they said very simply, look, we know the boundaries. We understand exactly. Within the boundaries, we're pretty free to do what we want. Cross the boundaries and you're finished. And so something of that, and that's what I mean by deterrence. I don't mean, you know, you have to go to Armageddon, but you have to find a way of sort of setting the boundaries. And I think, you know, this is in our interest as a Westerner, that Russia should be able to have to try and find some deterrence or boundaries with the United States. Now, that these 28 points withdraws all that. There's no sense of this. And what's more, what is also, you know, I mean, Russia is being treated like Estonia. Sorry to say it. I mean, you know, it's at the discretion of Mr. Trump. You know, he will decide what happens here. He will decide whether, you know, this is satisfactorily made. He will be, again, he is going to be president of a peace council that will ultimately decide. And that, you know, there won't be any security for Russia. There will be, and there's no guarantee that Ukraine will not join NATO. It's for discussion. It's just for discussion. Let's discuss that, NATO and Russia. In other words, it's blah, blah, blah.
Well, now let me go down an additional problem. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of difficulties with the 28 points with Russia itself. And as it turns out, they're not Estonia. So they have some power to decide yes or no on some of these things. But as it turns out, Trump also was going to have some difficulty on both the Ukraine and European side as well. And that headline was kind of one example of it, where they're claiming that you're giving away the farm, even though the Russians feel like you're not even coming close. But Trump's being accused in the opposite direction of giving everything away to Russia, et cetera. And you saw that we started off the show with Zelensky just, you know, saying it's up to freedom and everything, basically trying to make Trump sound like the villain if he forces this on Ukraine, and he's just this, you know, noble character, et cetera. I mean, that's what he's trying to play, and that works with a lot of people. What do you think? And let's just start off with Europe, and then we'll come back to Ukraine separately. What is Europe going to do in terms of these peace plans to agree on this border and these boundaries, as you talk about?
Well, first of all, I would say, and I've been, you know, engaged in negotiations with groups that are on the terrorist list and also called extremist groups for all my career. And so I've done these negotiations with Iran, with Hezbollah, with other people, other groups on this. And I, looking at the situation between Ukraine and the United States and Russia, I don't see any prospect for an agreement within the present paradigm. The paradigm changes, well, maybe then there will be different, but I don't see the possibility of a negotiated outcome on the paradigm as it stands at all. Now, Europe is you know, a complete block on the whole process. I mean, their aim is to undermine it because they want the war to continue. They want the war to continue. They want a ceasefire, not a solution. They want a ceasefire in Ukraine so that they can go back in, rearm, retrain. They say this explicitly. It's not my presumption. They want to retrain the Ukrainians, and they want to continue the war with Russia because our elites in Europe are desperate. They have nothing else to hold the European Union and the whole NATO together other than flying the flag. Let's rally to the flag of Ukraine, part of Europe. It's not part of Europe. They're Slavs, just as Russia are Slavs. Genetically, they have no connection with Europe any more than Russia is a European state. So, you know, but let's, you know, support our European family against those dangerous Slavs in the East. And this is the only thing, because otherwise everything will fracture. Can you? I mean, I was in the European Union working for the security and foreign policy chief for several years, Javier Solana, who was a former secretary general of NATO. And I was part of his staff and lent by the government to him for that purpose. And I remember him saying to me, you know, the Americans are really pressing us to take on the new Europeans, as the Americans called it. This is Poland, the Baltic states, all of those former Soviet elements. And he said, you know, I mean, it's going to be a disaster. It's going to break Europe ultimately if we do it. And you know why they did it? Because, you know, old Europe, France and Germany, voted against going to war in Iraq, the second Iraqi war. You remember the French said, oh, yeah. No, we disagree. So America started empowering, if you like, new Europe to become the tail that wags the European dog, which it is. I mean, the Baltic states have almost all the top jobs in Europe, despite being, you know, pinpoints on the map. And there are great fractures between the Mediterranean states and the austerity states, all these things.
And as it's turning out, that tail is still trying to wag the dog, even as we speak here. I want to show you this comment by Kaya Kallas, basically the foreign diplomat for the European Union. She was asked by a reporter, is Trump the only one that can bring peace, and will you follow what he says? What's your reaction?
Of course, for any plan to work, it needs Ukrainians and Europeans on board. So this is very clear. Also, we have to understand that in this war, there is one aggressor and one victim. So we haven't heard of any concessions on the Russian side. I mean, if Russia really wanted peace, it could have, agreed to unconditional ceasefire already some time ago.
And actually, at the head of that soundbite there, the reporter said, will you follow Trump's plan? And she straight up says no, and then goes on to explain whatever. So, I mean, that's if Zelensky in that opening dialogue we talked about there is telling, now admitting to everyone that Trump is trying to pressure him into an outcome and he didn't want to do it. And now here's Kaya Kallas for the European Union saying, yeah, his plan's not going to work. So who's it going to work for?
Everybody in Europe, all the Europeans, the coalition of the willing, as they call it, are coaching Zelensky and training him to say no. That's it. They are trying to block the any resolution of this. It's very clear. And as I say, the aim ultimately is not to go themselves and fight a war with Russia, but to bring America into the conflict in some way. So they want, if you like, a process in which Russia is trapped into a ceasefire.
And I'm sorry, Mr. Ambassador, let me ask a question on that. I want to go in. That's just a couple of times you've said that, and that leads to a disturbing question, which I would like to openly address. The Europeans are trying to draw the United States into a Pearl Harbor's top situation so that they can have a controlled war, what is the purpose of that? What are they trying to, what's the outcome? What would they hope to achieve? And as important, equally important, maybe more so, what about the morality of literally trying to start a war just to achieve some policy outcome? That doesn't seem to be what Europe used to stand for.
It's completely devoid of morality in Europe now. This is just cynical power plays that are taking place, I'm sorry to say. I mean, don't believe all that talk about European values. You know, they have been overridden and sort of blanked out during this period. And so what are they looking for? Well, Europe needs, as Europe had in the past, it needs resources. It needs cheap energy. And now it is bereft of all of that. It's bereft of gas, natural pipe gas. It's bereft of now even refined products under sanction. Our energy costs, if you take a country like Britain, are the highest in the world. The electricity costs are the highest in the world. Energy costs in Europe are the highest, almost bar any. It's about six times what you do have in Europe. What is your manufacturing base? What is your business model? They're at odds with the United States. They're at odds with China. There's no business model. And indeed, they suffer from a fractured economy. A completely bifurcated economy. We have 10% in Europe who live the life of Riley, who are what are called the cornucopia sector of the economy, and the rest are slowly sinking. I'm talking to you from Europe, where there has been no increase in real wages since joining the euro, which was in 93, I think. 92, 93, it joined it. No, I mean, a slow decline in real wages for that long. That's a long, long time. And that's the same. And people are getting desperate. They're getting to the edge. And the elites know that. They don't know what to do. They're desperate. They're desperate to try and keep their position, and they're desperate about their economic situation.
And dare Britain I say it, because I think you're probably one how very qualified to answer this question. Dare I say that there might be a better path to solving every one of those economic and other problems to national security that you just mentioned by having a negotiated, just normal relations with Russia to facilitate that? There is another path to accomplish those objectives, is there not?
Of course, but you're not allowed to say that. Look what happens when AfD, Alternative für Deutschland in Germany, which is now the most popular mainstream party in Germany, and they have said we need to have a relationship with, and they have many more of the young people were voting for AfD than the traditional established parties. And they say we want to have a relationship with Russia, and we need to have an understanding for energy sources. Germany produces high-end, or used to produce high-end engineering products on the basis of cheap Russian gas. And you take that away, and the rest of the economy is in complete decline. It is breaking up, and unemployment is rising just across Europe as a consequence. So what happens? They had an election recently in Germany, it wasn't a national election, a regional election in the area, and suddenly all of the AfD candidates were eliminated or died suddenly, seven of them. And the election was a collapse. And look at it anywhere. You try and start a party that advocates against a membership of NATO or joining or having relations with Russia, and the party leaders, suddenly they will find some sort of economic scandal or some sexual pedicilio that will enable them to be banned. They're still talking about banning AfD, the most popular party. This is called the cordon sanitaire in Europe. Since the war, the center parties have refused to allow what they call the far left or the far right, and the far right is not far right, and the far left is not far left. It is just these two. So it's just the center. And what Europe has done is to demolish all the bridges to the future. And so,
and I'm wondering, is there a similar situation in the UK? Because as I understand it, Labour and Tories, who have always dominated, now that they're moving to the sideline, can you tell us a little bit about what that's about?
Yes. The people became extremely angry with the last Conservative government, viciously angry with it, and wanted to give it a slap. So in the polls, they gave it a very hard slap. But with by virtue of the structures of parliament, on a tiny minority, then the Labour came into power. And now the popular sentiment hates Labour and the Starmer. We had a huge protest in England not so long ago, about a month ago, supposedly led by Tommy Robinson. But the language, I mean, it was about a million plus. Angry, I mean, really ugly language against the elites, the leadership, Starmer particularly, vicious, violent language against the elites, the oligarchs, the rich establishment, by people, and, you know, and they want a stop to immigration. They want immigrants to leave the country. Because immigrants are seen in the UK, whether that is absolutely correct or not, but they are believed by many of the population to be responsible for violent crime in Britain. And there was a scandal of the grooming gangs a little earlier when Starmer was head of the prosecution service. Of young white working class girls who were taken, kidnapped essentially, and taken to be groomed for paedophilia in the country. So it can be quite ugly, and the mood is quite bitter. I'm sure you understand it in a different way from your experience in the United States. But this is general in the West, and there's no answer. That's the problem. Whether it's Conservative or Labour, they're both uniparty. They don't have a sort of a difference. And the only people who will win an election or can win an election in the future will be those that can produce a credible plan to create the bread and butter needs of ordinary people, jobs, living wage, medical care. These things are the essential that have disappeared or are in the process of disappearing in Europe. And they've got to get them, got to provide a critical answer. But you can't do that in Europe or in America because we've had financialization for so many decades, and certainly from 2008, where everything has become, you know, about assets rising. So you have, you know, the market goes up exponentially with the assets, and job openings is declining sharply. And you can't change that because you'd have to change the whole financial system, the banking system, because where does credit go? Does credit go to small businesses? Does credit go to ordinary individuals, or is it all funneled to the big hedge funds and the banks who want to lend against financial assets? And that's the problem, and there's no easy answer. So the many Europeans that are deeply alienated against both sides of the establishment.
And is that part of what's going on in Britain with Nigel Farage, I believe, and his move there to try to provide a sample like that? Am I understanding correctly?
Exactly, yes. He's presenting himself as an outsider who can come in and change the system. But, you know, Liz Truss, I don't know if you recall, yeah. She was elected a prime minister and she was ousted within about 3 days. Right. And she wrote a book and she's done videos and they're on the net. You can see, and she said, you know, I couldn't believe it. I'd just been elected prime minister. And I thought that meant I could, you know, organize policies, that I could have a say in policy, that I could make decisions about the economy. And I came in and I found that was not possible. I had no decisions were left to me about the economy because it was all the technocracy, the professional technocracy who had a certain mindset and they controlled the system. They controlled the examination, the mechanical processes of government down. They would just block anything that I wanted to do. And they say, no, you know, I'm sorry, madam, you can't do that. I'm afraid it's not going to pass law. There'll be problems in the implementation. And she said, I couldn't believe it. I could do nothing. I was prime minister, just elected, and I was completely blocked from making any economic changes, from making changes about social matters, welfare, immigration, blocked.
Can we assume, therefore, that your current prime minister is a creature of the system and is more than happy to do whatever that bureaucracy desires?
He's parachuted in to do what the establishment wanted. Yes. I mean, that's the system in Europe.
Well, then let me ask you in the last few minutes that we have here before we let you go, where is this going to go now? If you have Russia saying no to these 28 points, Europe saying no, Ukraine saying no, what does that tell you about where this war is going?
I think it's going to escalation. I think that's where, I mean, I think ultimately the West will not be able to accept with equanimity the defeat of NATO by Russia on the battlefield, and that it'll find that, you know, you'll find people who will say, I just cannot imagine living in a world where Europe or America is not directing the world, that Russia is blocking us. I cannot imagine it. It cannot happen. We will not allow it to happen. And so they go on saying these crazy things about, you know, 1.5 million Russians dead and they can't, their army is falling apart and things. They don't believe it themselves, but they cannot imagine a world in which the West does not give the orders.
Well, I think a pretty accurate assessment, but that it's based on the facts. The evidence lines up with what you're saying and the words that are being said by the Europeans, by the Ukrainians, don't line up to reality. And at some point, these aspirations aside, they're going to lay the foundation. You tell me if you think I'm wrong, to where it's going to force Russia that the only choice they have is military outright conquest. And that's the only way they're going to get any kind of security. Do you see it differently?
No, that's exactly what Putin said in your little piece that you put up earlier. I mean, he always says these things in a very measured and clean way, but he said, you know, our people require and need us to complete the special military operation in its entirety. That means denazification, neutralization of Ukraine, and then to have a political process from that position. And, you know, as a former negotiator, I recognize it sometimes when there is just too great an oppositional process. You know, there has to be a trial of strength. And when the trial of strength has happened, then possibly you can negotiate your boundaries and your solution to go in and get some sort of solution from it.
Well, listen, Mr. Ambassador, I cannot tell you how grateful we are to you, the incredible clarity and history and experience that you have and showing us exactly what we're really facing here. One of the things that is so important about having a show like this and having these kinds of words out there is it is on record. And when things happen the way that the evidence and the elements show that it's likely to happen, when it rolls out that way, then these people can't later on claim that, oh, we didn't ever see it coming, because we did. And you pointed out in time to we could, even now, with all the disasters that we've done for the last nearly 4 years now, even at this point, it's still possible to avoid the worst outcomes for the people of Ukraine and for European security. But it doesn't look to me like we're going to take it.
Sadly, so.
Well, but in any case, we are going to continue to talk about the truth because we're unintimidated and we're just not going to be stopping because people deserve to know the truth. And you've really showed it to us today. We recommend it. People go to your Substack there. Boy, you probably can't get enough of Ambassador Crook here just on this one show here. So by all means, go and read his stuff there as we do as well to really understand what's happening. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we appreciate you guys. And by the way, Larry Johnson has just returned recently from Moscow, where he's talked to a lot of these decision makers personally. And he's got some really interesting things to share with us here at 1 o'clock Eastern time. So it's a little over an hour from now. Do not miss that show. I promise you, you will not be disappointed. Thank you very much, folks. And we'll see you there on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.